Well, welcome everyone to another edition of the Ben's Podcast, Five Questions with the CEO, where we take the time to talk with our Ben's members about their professional expertise and experience and about what brought them to Ben's. Today's guest is New York member David Bonfili. David is the co-founder and CEO of Acme General Corporation, a business consulting firm that serves the defense industry. Through an array of services, they bridge the gap between government problem holders and non-traditional solvers. So, David, welcome to our podcast today.
Well, General, thanks for having me. It's a real privilege to be here.
Good. Well, we're looking forward to chatting with this afternoon. And I wonder if maybe let's go ahead and get right into it here. And since I introduced a little bit on Acme, I wonder if you can share with us a little bit more about what Acme does.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, in terms of my own background, the first part had been in national security and the second part in finance. And when I left a hedge fund in 2018, I was thinking about where I was in my career and what had been satisfying and what hadn't, and wanted to do something that felt like it was connected more to a sense of mission than just making rich people richer, which I'm not opposed to, but is probably not a fulsome life goal. And so I partnered with a friend who had experience as an entrepreneur. And the thesis was that my experience in the national security community and his experience in entrepreneurship combined with my background in finance would let us translate across these different communities of government innovators and commercial solvers and the investors who back them. So we formed Acme in 2018 to sort of focus on that intersection. We do a combination of work that faces the government and helps government innovation arms try to be more effective in executing their mission, and then other work that faces startups, commercial interests, and tries to help them figure out how to work more effectively with the government.
That's great. Well, we're going to get a little bit more into the innovation stuff in a moment here, but I want to make note of the fact that you have some other fairly extensive experience in business at Citadel, at BlackRock, at Two Sigma, and of course, you were also a former nuclear submarine officer and a naval intelligence officer. So I'm wondering if you could, as you kind of reflect back on the experiences that you've had, David, what are the kind of the lessons learned or the skills that you brought forward from those experiences to what you're doing now at Acme today?
Yeah, it's interesting because they're two very different worlds in a lot of ways, but I think also complementary. If I reflect back on my time in the service, one of the things is obviously well, sir, is there's an emphasis on sort of the idea of mission and the idea of people. How do you what is your sense of purpose? What is it directed at? And how do you take care of your people, develop them professionally, devolve authority down to lower levels of decision making to allow for flexible response and provide the sort of feedback that people need in order to understand what they're doing well and how they can improve. A lot of that doesn't really exist in sort of big finance. You hire people at hedge funds, for example, who already know how to do the job that they do. You expect them to be very focused and specialized and to just keep doing it. And then you replace them if you find someone better. And so the sort of idea that you need to have mission and purpose and you need to develop your people and devolve authority was something that was important to me and a little foreign to the hedge funds. On the other hand, I think one of the things that was very useful for me in developing my career in the private sector was understanding just how important it is to have an alignment of interests and incentives that reflect that, that people need to be rewarded taking smart, thoughtful risk and to understand that if they take those risks and are successful, that there's upside that makes it worth it, which is often hard to replicate on the government side. And they also need to be held accountable in the sense that if people are not a good fit for the job that they're in, sometimes the answer isn't to keep trying to develop them and help them figure out how to do it. Sometimes the answer is they need to find something else to do that's a better fit for their talent. And that was sort of a foreign concept to me coming in. I think, you know, the other thing that sort of is a overarching tie into all of that is this idea of metrics and having clear objectives and key results that you define in advance, track to, and then use to hold people accountable and use to assess who's really capable and not of the jobs at hand.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. I mean, you've got an incredible amount of experience. And I should tell you that about a week and a half ago, I actually had the opportunity to be on a nuclear submarine out in the Pacific there and in the Pearl Harbor area. It was fascinating. As fascinating as the submarine was, I was so fascinated by the young officers and actually the Commodore that was there, because you just really get a sense of the level of expertise that comes along with that and how that kind of plays over into some of their leadership skills as they move forward. And you know, as an infantry officer, I mean, I would consider those two things to be different worlds, but yet I've actually found a lot of commonalities between the ways we were thinking about things. So it was just fascinating experience for me and some of the members who were with us. So, you know, ACME regularly hosts both virtual and live innovation ecosystem development events. And I wonder if you can tell our listeners here a little bit about those and about how you try to use those things to spark innovation.
One of the things that's interesting for us as we were launching the company is that we ended up with a physical presence in a couple of different locations. We had an office in Austin, Texas, where we do a lot of work with the Army Futures Command. We had a presence here in New York City, where I'm based, and we had offices in some smaller locations like Morgantown, West Virginia, and Youngstown, Ohio. And one of the things that we realized early on as a result of that was that there's a sort of interesting lens when it comes to working with the government that doesn't relate to the way we typically think about locations, where you might put an Austin and a New York next to each other and say they're both large tech hubs and they both have a lot of capital, whereas like a place like, let's say, Dayton, Ohio doesn't. But in terms of working with the government, someplace like Dayton and someplace like Austin may have a lot more in common than an Austin and New York, because there's a government presence. There are people who previously served. There's an understanding of the ecosystem already in place in those locations. And so you get these sort of weird anomalies where places like New York that seem so connected into what's going on in the commercial development space have no idea what's happening in the government space. And at the same time, there's this tremendous interest in getting involved and contributing. I mean, just no idea how to do that. There's no one in New York City is sitting on SAM.gov, the awards management system, waiting for the next proposal request to drop. It just doesn't happen. And so it was clear to us early on that you have to meet people where they are, in the forums that they pay attention to and in the geographies where they're located. And that when you do that, that's the first step. The second step is you then need to figure out how to connect them into the national security innovation ecosystem. You need to figure out how to educate people about what being a part of that innovation ecosystem involves, whether it's cybersecurity requirements or compliant accounting systems or just understanding the pace at which contracts move and how to do bid and proposal. And you have to enable them with the tools to be able to successfully engage in that environment. So it's a lot of sort of at the forest floor level stuff versus kind of the 30,000 foot perspective, if you want to really do more good than harm. Because I think what happens otherwise is, even when companies sort of stumble their way into engaging with the government, they don't understand what's actually required when they start to do that. And so they find the timelines are too long, the checks are too small, they can't speak the right language, or they don't have systems that are compliant, or they need security clearances and they don't realize how long it takes to get them. And so being able to not just connect them in, but help understand what's really involved and engaging in a meaningful way in the space is pretty important. So that's what we try and do.
That's great. Wow, that's a real service, I think, to help people understand that. And I like the way you describe that kind of as the ecosystem here. So I suspect our Ben's audience is tracking pretty closely on many of the topics and conversations that appear in Acme's podcast. And I was looking at this on your site today, kind of the Accelerate Defense podcast that you all are doing. I bet many are probably the regular listeners to your show. And the theme of innovation and national security is really central to the work at Ben's and at Acme. As you kind of think about this area, what are the priorities? What are your priorities? What do you think are of the priorities for the nation's innovation agenda? And how do you rate some of the proposals, whether they're legislative or otherwise, that are bouncing around out there to help us be better in this area?
Well, I really appreciate the first of all mentioning the podcast Accelerate Defense, hosted by my colleague Ken Harbaugh. It's our attempt to reach out to a broader audience, and one of the things that we're trying to do there that I think starts to get at your question is, and we're literally just starting this, so it's you'll see it if you tune in over the next couple of months. But we've started thinking about the interviews as three interlocking pieces, where we talk first to someone on the government side who's trying to drive innovation. We talk next to a company that's involved in those innovation efforts, that's a non-traditional innovator. And then we talk to investors who are trying to invest in the space. And the conversations are general, but they're overlapping. And then we try and pull those together to sort of show Rashomon style, three different perspectives on where those points of intersection are and where people are misaligned as well. So I think developing that kind of understanding of where there is alignment of interest and where there isn't across the otherwise stovepipe communities is pretty important and one of the things we're trying to do. In terms of specific proposals, you know, the thing that's, I think, frustrating if you're trying to pull commercial technology in is realizing just how broken things are, because it is difficult to point to one lever that you would pull versus another. I think everyone recognizes that the budgeting process, which is a legacy of McNamara's Defense Department in the 1960s and sort of the best thinking out of Ford, you know, 60 years ago, is something that has to change, that doesn't move at a relevant speed for the pace at which technology changes today. There's a reform commission that's been put together to take a look at that, and we're all hopeful to see what comes out of it. But it's you know, in part, the PPB process reflects the necessary relationship between Congress and the department. And so there are sort of restrictions, I think, on how far you can go in executing change without real trust between those two bodies and without recognizing the incentives in place on both sides. I think you can also look at the requirements generation process. You can look at how acquisition is devolved down to the service level in a world where increasingly everything that we're talking about and saying involves being joint and integrating data and systems. And that's just really hard to do when your acquisition authority is largely owned by the services and not at a joint or departmental level. And I think the last thing that I would point to, and I know it's something that you probably have more experience with than just about anyone, is how do we address the things that we miss, the urgent operational needs that are developed and sourced in the field in a timeline that makes any difference to anyone who is faced with them? And obviously, I think for people who are familiar with your background, you really led a lot of those efforts in the early days in Iraq around improvised explosive devices and organizations like the Joint IED Defeat Organization and the Asymmetric Warfare Group and the REF. The Rapid Equipping Force that all came out of that were, I think, really good examples of how we can try and get at it. But if you even take that as an example and look at it today, the Asymmetric Warfare Group has been wound down. The Rapid Equipping Force has been wound down. Joint ID Defeat Organization has gone through multiple iterations. And so, like, where are the equivalents today for being able to sprint when we need to sprint?
Yeah, thanks for that, and thanks for bringing up the idea. I'm still in therapy over that whole episode there, but nonetheless, it was a great effort. And as you pointed out, I mean, it was something I was completely unprepared to deal with. But again, when you know that lives are on the line, you really have to move out and get things going. And I was pretty proud of a lot of things set up. But I, again, as you pointed out, I'm disappointed things like the asymmetric warfare group and the REF and some of these other things have kind of migrated away because they don't cleanly fit into the bureaucracy or the institutional aspects of the military. And as a result, those organizations were around for 10, 12, 15 years. And yet that wasn't enough time for them to really gain a purchase that, you know, made them unassailable. And as soon as we could, we kind of got rid of them. So yeah, it's a real challenge here. Hey David, I want to ask you, among the many impressive highlights in your educational history was studying at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. Is there an issue that you researched as a student that you look back on today with a much different perspective after a career like you have had?
So, you know, sir, it's funny. When I went to Oxford, I had just been commissioned as a nuclear submarine officer, and the detailer for the Navy called me up and said, okay, I understand you're going to grad school at Oxford. What kind of engineering are you going to study? And I said, comparative constitutional engineering. And there was a silence on the line. And he said, what is that and why did the Navy care about it? And the sort of thesis for me at the time was that if you're really concerned about how we sustain and develop and equip the force, this intersection between Congress and the executive branch is critical to understand. And so understanding how those organizations are created, the incentives that emerge as a result, and sort of how that shapes the realm of the possible is really important. I actually did my graduate work on congressional districting in the U.S., looking at how we draw congressional district lines and how that's changed over time. And you know, one of the things that has happened is districts have become more concentrated from a political partisan perspective. So they tend, relative to the past, to be more Republican or more Democrat than they used to be. And so sort of median voter has shifted away from the middle, and we elect people to Congress who have a harder time meeting in the middle because their constituents are further away from the center. And so, you know, if anything, I'm not sure that it's a change through my experience in the government contracting world, but it's understanding how interests can be very parochial, and how, you know, we spend all this time talking about how hard it is to get new things built. It's equally hard to kill things that we've started building that need to go away, because once you start building them, you've created jobs. And those jobs are in a district, and losing those jobs has a real impact. And so it's not that anyone is not being sensible relative to the incentives that drive there every day, but at some point you have to think about sort of the kind of greater calling here. And so, you know, the podcast that you mentioned earlier, we started out talking to people on the Hill to try and understand that dynamic better. And it's what's encouraging, I think, is there's a group of folks on both sides of the aisle, you know, many of whom have prior service, many of whom are on the younger side, who've come in really thinking about how do you put country first, and how do you make the hard decisions that you need to make to do that. And it's one of the areas where, you know, as you well know, Ben's has been historically, I think, very impactful is in helping to depoliticize, remove the partisan element from some of these tough political decisions that are important for the country.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great response. Thanks so much for that. And I, again, I would underscore the content in your podcast series there. I mean, as I kind of went through today, I've counted at least five or six members of Congress on both sides who have been interviewed there, at least in what I quickly saw as I went through it today. And it's an impressive group. And as you pointed out, it's a lot of younger members of Congress where, you know, the real opportunity is, I think, to create some long-term change. So thanks for highlighting that. time. So we're coming to the end of the podcast, and I want to ask you the question I really ask everybody that I talk to on this, and that is, what brought you to Benz, David?
It's been a part of my career, obviously the first and a very important part in the national security community, and then the second part really focused on finance for its own sake. And as I made the sort of transition into trying to look at the intersection of the two, being a part of a community of like-minded folks who have experience in the business sector, recognize the importance of national defense, and recognize that it's the two aren't separate, that there's an intersection between the two, that as a country we have to understand, whether that's how you balance economic opportunities in a market like China with threats to intellectual property and national security that emerges as a result of that, like they're not separate worlds. It's not about being a tourist in one while occupying the other. They're clearly overlapping, intersecting. And so to me, Benz is a fantastic organization that allows people to understand that intersection. Well, it's not just sort of exposure to a different world, but seeing how the worlds aren't actually that different at all. And that's an important connection to make.
That's great. Thank you as well. Thank you, David. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and hear some of your insights on your work at Acme and some of the direction in which you're going there. So thanks so much for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me, sir.
And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us today for this episode. We've been talking with Benz New York member David Bonfili, who's the co-founder and CEO of Acme General Corporation, a business consulting firm that serves the defense industry. And we look forward to bringing you more episodes here in the future. And thanks so much for joining us.